What do you
have?
Things have been so high or it's been cloudy.
Yep. What kind of scope do you have?
I've got a 16-inch Dob.
Wow. Wow, wonderful. Do you do imaging as well, or just observing?
I'm going to start doing imaging here this spring. I just bought a tracking platform for it. I'm going to pick up a camera for it and try my hand at it.
Uh-huh, yeah, I'm actually in exactly the same place. Most everybody uses Canon, but I sort of bucked the trend, and I have a Nikon that I'm going to use.
How's that working?
I won't know till it's too rough to take it out now, but it's cold here, and the winters here are generally really cloudy, and by the time you set things up, I have to go out into the country to set it up. I'm in the city. I hope there's more than us coming.
Yeah, I hope so, because this one sounds kind of interesting.
Absolutely. I downloaded the presentation, but I haven't gone through it yet.
I went through about all first five or six of them, and it looked pretty interesting, and I downloaded the PowerPoint, too, just to know. It seems like these guys can go either way sometimes. So.
Oh, okay. I should do that, too, because I like getting the PowerPoint because I can use them in on the website.
Right. Yeah, he's got a nice little added feature to keep clicking on a few of the slides. It keeps adding stuff to it. And I think it's down in the 20s somewhere, if I remember right. Yeah, check out my site sometime, Dave, if you got time. It's rusticskies.com.
Rustic Skies?
Yeah.
Okie doke.
And what's yours?
Mine is called Eclectic Planet.
Oh, would you spell that one, please?
Yep. ECLECTIC, eclectic.
Okay.
Did I spell that right? Planet. And that's all one word.
Okay. And then .com or .org? Or?
Right now it's .com, but I'm thinking of changing it to .org.
Cool.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's Julie, the speaker.
Oh, hello, Julie. David Del Monte here from D.C. I'm a solar system ambassador.
Oh, great. Nice to meet you.
You too.
Is Jane online?
I don't know who else is on. Kevin from Wisconsin is online,
mm-hmm.
but we have not heard from anybody else yet.
Okay.
But everybody's usually last moment.
Okay.
Where are you from?
I'm from France.
Ah, I'm originally from London.
Oh, okay. So I hope my English will be okay.
Oh, it sounds great.
So what do you do as an ambassador?
I do several things. The main goal is to get into the local school systems here and try to get to the kids at risk. And kind of amaze them with what's going on and get them curious and give them some sort of context for staying in school. I also put out newsletters and I'm building a website.
Oh, nice.
So the newsletter, when there's announcements like LCROSS or LRO or Cassini, I can actually send that to about 25,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, it's there's lots of astronomy groups and space science discussion groups. So whatever you tell us is okay to put out, I will. We will.
Excuse me, this is Jane. I'm going to be the host today. Oh, hi, Jane. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jane. This is TV.
Oh, hi, TV. How are you? Long time no here.
Oh, I know. I switched jobs.
Oh, you did?
Yes. I'm working for NASA Dryden now.
No kidding. Awesome.
Yes, no kidding. I was there last weekend for the Extreme Environment
Oh, you were?
Conference. And I met Oh, what's her name? I met one of the Cassini educators.
Rachel Zimmerman Brockman.
Rachel.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah, hi, Rachel. Rachel.
Hey, Rachel, how are you? Long time no see you.
TB's one of our great Saturn Observation Campaign members. And you're a solar system ambassador, too, aren't you?
Yes. And
yeah,
I'm
you're everything.
Yes.
She's everything.
Yes. And what? How have you been doing, Janet? I haven't talked to you. That's right. That's correct.
Yeah. Oh, I'm just doing great. What I wanted to do, though, is while everybody's talking, you can continue talking for a few minutes, but
okay.
In about 1 minute, I'm going to go off and have the operator tell her it's time to start recording. And then at that point, I'd like everybody who's talking to not and let Julie talk. But,
hi, Julie. Nice
yeah.
meeting you.
Yeah. But for right now, go ahead and you can all chat among yourselves for a few minutes.
Hi, Jane. Pete Goldie.
Hey, Pete. Gosh, it's all my buddies.
Well,
yeah, I moved from North Dakota to California.
Yeah.
And I don't miss the weather at all.
Yeah. Cool. Well, you're just right around the corner from us now.
Yeah. I will be coming sometime over there because I'm still on training, kind of like it. So I would love to come and see you over there to meet with you and see if we can develop some activities in Spanish.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, I speak the language fluently, so I would
I know you do.
I would love to do that.
Yeah. We actually, Rachel, well, you can talk to Rachel about Reading, Writing, and Rings, our educator program, which we do have some of those things in Spanish.
Yeah, I saw that.
Okay, well, how about if I... it's 2 minutes after 11. How about if I go off and tell the operator to come in and say her thing, and then I'll formally introduce Julie to everyone.
Okay. Good.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks.
Are we on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. As Joe Hilby, I just signed in. Check in.
Hey, where is Julie from?
Oh, I'm from France.
Excuse me, please. This is the operator, and at this time, I would like to just remind participants that today's call will be recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Thank you, and thank you, everyone. We have a really exciting talk today for our first Charm Telecon of 2009, and we're really lucky because this is the week of our Cassini Project Science Group meeting where all the scientists from Cassini are right here at JPL this week. And I'm sure Julie would, she probably has to be missing some interesting presentations in order to give us the talk today. But her talk is called Geophysical Study of Iapetus Constrained by Cassini Observations. And Julie received her PhD in geophysics, Earth geophysics, and came to Jet Propulsion Laboratory in 2002 as a NASA postdoc working for the Cassini Radio Science Team. After that, she was a Caltech postdoc with our Cassini Chief Scientist Dennis Mattson. And now she's a scientist in the JPL Planetary ICES group. Before she gets started, for those of you who maybe haven't called into the telecons for a while, if you have any background noise, like you're on a conference call or something like that, all of us can hear all of those background noises, and so it's a great idea to do to mute by hitting star 6, and then if you have a question to ask, hit star 6 again, and it'll bring you live. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Julie Castillo.
Thank you so much, Jane, and thank you very much for inviting me to do that presentation. I'm going to present you results that we have published in 2007, the end of 2007. But what I'm going to do today is to present something a little bit unusual, maybe, in the sense that I'm going to present you a lot of laboratory work, which is used to constrain the models we do for IC satellites. And we have developed new facilities at JPL that help us simulate conditions in IC satellites. So that material will be very new. But first, let's start from the beginning. Cathy made an observation of diabetes at the end of 2004. And so if we go to slide number, I just give the number, the, sorry, you all have the presentation?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so I go to the second slide, which is entitled Research Focus and Significance. And I have presented a picture of diabetes that was obtained at the end of 2004, and it shows that the subject is very, very weird in the sense that it shows a very strong gradient in surface color. It's brighter at the poles and darker at low latitudes. And we've known that for a while, that diabetes is very special. But on top of that, we've also found that diabetes bears very large craters, and some craters can be up to 800 kilometers large. So these are the larger craters in the outer solar system. And there is also something that maybe you don't see very clearly in that picture, but I'll talk again about that later. It's the presence at the equator of a ridge, a linear feature which is very well delineated, and it's almost at the equator. And it's unique that the only object we know of that has this equatorial feature. So why is it so interesting to study diabetes and icy satellites in general? It's because these objects, they contain information about the early solar system. And it's also interesting to understand how life could have developed in these icy worlds. So all note these objects are likely to host liquid water. I mean, Enceladus is more likely to have liquid water at depth than Iapetus. But understanding how Iapetus and Enceladus evolved and why they are so different today is key. It's part of understanding whether or not there is liquid water in Enceladus. Iapetus is also compared sometimes to Phoebe, and I present a picture of Phoebe. It's a map of Phoebe, actually, a topography map of Phoebe that has been obtained by Cassini ISS team. And people believe that the material detected on Phoebe, the composition of Phoebe, matches, at least in part, that composition matches the composition of Iapetus' dark material. So people are trying to understand how these objects could have some genetic link. How is it possible that, I mean, either there was an object with the same composition of Phoebe that crashed on Iapetus, for example, and this resulted in this dark mantle at the surface of Iapetus, or maybe, I don't know, it's very hard to understand what has been going on. But people are working a lot on understanding the link, potential link between Phoebe and Iapetus. And I also show a picture of Ceres, the light, but it's an icy asteroid. It's the largest icy asteroid, actually, the main belt. It's about 800 kilometers in diameter. No, 950 kilometers in diameter. And Ceres is interesting because it has also the same surface characteristics as Enceladus or Iapetus. It has about the same composition as Phoebe and Iapetus, not Enceladus. Phoebe and Iapetus and Ceres show the same colors, the same composition, same material, and there is a link between these three objects that people are trying to understand. So I go to the next slide. This shows now bigger picture of Iapetus, and I'm not going to talk about the variations of surface composition and surface color. I'm going to focus on the geology and the geophysics of Iapetus today. So first, there was something absolutely striking with Iapetus's shape. It is that it's extremely oblate. It's much more oblate than the moon. The moon is known to be oblate. And to have a fossil bulge, that is that there is a way to determine the theoretical shape of an object if we assume its internal structure and we know its rotation period and tides. It's possible to make a theoretical calculation of what the shape of an object would be. And if the observed shape is very different from the calculation, then we say that there is an anomaly of shape, an anomaly of topography. Also, we say that
The object is not in hydrostatic equilibrium. It's not relaxed to the theoretical shape it would have. If something happened in the case of Iapetus, for sure. Because the difference between its equatorial radius A and its polar radius is 33 kilometers. So the real shape is shown by the green circle. And the theoretical shape that Iapetus would have if it met the requirements from the theoretical calculation is indicated so this is indicated in red. And the difference between the equatorial and the polar radii should be only 10 meters. So there is 33 kilometers of shape anomaly that characterizes Iapetus. And that's much more than anything that has been observed in the entire solar system for objects that large. So another important aspect of Iapetus is that it's in synchronous rotation. This means that the same face always faces Saturn in the same way that the Moon always faces the Earth, more or less. There is some librational effect most of the time. The same face of the Moon is pointing towards the Earth. So why is it so abnormal? All the Saturnian satellites, except Phoebe, all the large Saturnian satellites show the same face to Saturn. Why is it so abnormal that Iapetus basically is like the other satellites? This is because it's very, very far from Saturn. It's about 60 radii far from Saturn. To give you a reference, Enceladus is only 3 radii away from Saturn. So many people have believed that Iapetus should not have this sun. It should not have become to this synchronous state when it shows always the same face to Saturn. I'm going to show you the reason why later. And besides these two aspects, the shape and synchronous rotation, there is also the presence of this equatorial ridge, which is a real mystery. It's almost exactly at the equator. People just don't understand how this happened. The next slide is the zoom of the ridge. And the ridge is almost 5,000 kilometers in length, 100 kilometers wide, and up 20 kilometers high. So something interesting is that it was possible from crater canting to have a rough idea of the age of that ridge. And people believe that it formed shortly after Iapetus formed, like between 4.4 and 4.5 billion years ago. And just because we found that some craters cut the ridge, and we can see that in the picture I'm showing you. So I won't speak much about the ridge for the rest of the talk, but certainly there is a need to better understand what's going on with that picture.
Julia, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
TB, before you, would you say your name so that we can get who asks the questions into the written transcript, please? Thanks.
My name is TB Mirren, and the question I have is, you're talking about an equatorial ridge. As you're looking into the ridge being formed by tectonic processes, like maybe some magmatism or some internal geophysical forces, or I know not plate tectonics, but could be something related to mantle upwelling?
So people have been looking into that, and later on I'm going to show you some thermal models of Iapetus, so that you can see that there is little chance, little possibility for convection to take place or magmatism to take place inside Iapetus, because it's a very cold object. But yes, people have suggested that convection could have created the very strong obliqueness of Iapetus. And maybe, yes, this would have resulted in breaking the equator and from the ridge. So this is being considered, but it's not supported by the thermal models. Another scenario that has been suggested for Iapetus is the possibility that there was a ring of material around Iapetus. Like Iapetus formed from the accretion of planetesimals, and there were some planetesimal, some leftovers of material of icy and rock material around Iapetus, and that material collapsed later on, and some that reached at the equator. So it's been suggested that it's very unlikely. I mean, it's very difficult to link the two and to understand how the ridge would be exactly at the equator and would have this structure. I don't know if you can see well in the pictures. There are ridges in several slices going together. The ridge is multiple, basically, and it's difficult to understand how this would have could have resulted from just the impact, late impact of a ring of material. So it's a real mystery. I went to a meeting at the end of the year, the American Geophysical Union meeting, and there was someone who's been taking all the, looking at all the scenarios possible for explaining the reach, and at the end, she just that person just said, "We don't know. We can't." So, that's a real mystery.
Yeah. Steven Marine here. So, if you're thinking about it could be the ring, couldn't that be then the ring collapsed and was just absorbed by the planet, thin lithosphere in that case? And then, because as I look at the picture, you have craters who are secondary to the formation of the ridge. And I see dark areas of the ridge can give me some, I'm a geologist, so give me some ideas. It could be some geological processes going in there in the past, and maybe the ring collapsed in there, got stuck in. I don't know, I just thinking about that.
And from a dynamical point of view, it's difficult to understand how the ring of material could have collapsed in a very narrow area. But and in terms of just looking at the structure of the ridge, and there are many other pictures which are very good and are very helpful for geologists. People believe that there is a better chance that basically there's been some compression of the material close to the surface, and the ridge is the result of some compression with a north-south direction. In terms of the ring, yeah, I mean, it's not been very well studied. It's been suggested, but people have not really looked at the details of what we'd get, basically, if we have a ring of material that collapses. So at this stage, yeah, I would say the question is open, and hopefully people will work more on that topic in the future, because, it's an interesting topic. So I go on to the next slide. So that slide shows a picture of Iapetus, and it this is just a draft to a sketch to address what conditions the models, the geophysical models, have to meet in order to explain Iapetus. We need to have a very thick and stiff lithosphere in order to retain the very oblate shape. And I forgot to mention that earlier, but that shape, people believe that there's very strong oblateness of 33 meters, difference between the equatorial and polar radii, is was frozen when Iapetus had a rotation period of 17 hours. So this is just due to the fact that when an object very far, it tends to deform very much. The oblateness of that object is going to increase a lot. And when the object is spinning slower, like it's currently the case for Iapetus, then the oblateness tends towards zero. So today Iapetus has a period of 80 days, about 80 days. And as I told you earlier, the difference between the equatorial and polar radii should be only a few meters. But if we find a difference between the equatorial and the polar radii of several times, it's an indication that the shape was when the rotation period was very small, a few tenths of hours. So that's one thing. Is that it's very difficult. It's very difficult to explain from a modeling point of view how it's possible to retain 33 kilometers of radius difference between the equator and the pole. So the lithosphere of Iapetus has to be very cold and very thick, and it has to be at least 200-250 kilometers of very cold material. But an important fact is that in order for Iapetus to despin and become in synchronous rotation, its interior had to be dissipative, which means that it had to be warm for the object to dissipate heat and to evolve from a dynamical point of view. So I go to the next slide, and it just sketch how we have to integrate several types of modeling together in order to understand what's going on with Iapetus. So the dynamical evolution, so the evolution of the spin rate, the thermal evolution, the rheological evolution, which means the evolution of the mechanical properties of the materials that make up Iapetus. And these materials are going to be able to deform very easily if they are warm. And we know, for example, that in order to maintain the shape, this material had to be very cold and very stiff. So that gives us a constraint on the temperature of the lithosphere in order to, by the topology. So I go, the next slide, it shows the time it takes for Iapetus and any object in the outer solar system to despin and become synchronous as a function of their distance to Saturn. So I show this chart shows examples of all the Saturnian satellites except for Phoebe and the small ones. I'm not interested in the small ones for this chart. And it's in increasing distance from Saturn. So we start with Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, Rhea, Titan, and Iapetus. And you see that Iapetus is very far away from all the other satellites. And so that's the first thing. Second thing is that you can see in the bottom right of the chart that there is an equation. And it's a lot of parameters, but what this equation tells us is the time it takes, it's a rate, of change of spin rate, and so as a function of time. And the way the spin rate evolves with time is a function of many parameters, but the one which are very interesting to us, it's the distance to Saturn, to the semi-major axis, that's D, and it's to the power of 6, so it's a parameter that plays a big role in the evolution of the spin period. And the other parameter is called Q. Q is the dissipation factor. The dissipation factor, it's a parameter that gives you the amount of heat produced in a material if that material is strained and deformed in a cyclic way. And to give you an example, if you put your hands next to each other and you friction your hands together, you are going to produce heat. And that's an example of heat production as a result of friction. And the amount of heat that you're going to produce is a function of course, of the speed at which you friction your hands, but it's also a question of the shape of your hands. So if you had put together two surfaces which are very smooth, you're going to get less heat as a result of friction with respect to an experiment in which you put two surfaces which are very rough. Because of the roughness, there is going to be more opportunity for the material to friction and become hot. So it's the same thing in the case of all these objects which are subject to tidal stress, cyclic stress exerted by Saturn. The material is going to be deformed cyclically. It's going to be pushed and pulled on a regularly, cyclically. And the amount of heat which is produced in the object is a function of the properties of the material that make up these objects. And the property, the capacity of the icy material to produce heat as a result of the cyclical that parameter Q. And we have very few constraints on that parameter Q. This is changing because I'm going to show you later that we can measure that parameter in laboratories. But at the time I made that chart and I published that that model about iapetus, we had no clue about the value of Q, or very, very little clue about the value of Q. So people have made guesses, and it's what I do for slide. I've made some guess on the value of Q. If Q is equal to 10, it means that for a given amount of stress, the icy satellite material is going to dissipate a lot of heat. If Q is higher, like for 200, it means that for that same amount of stress, the material is going to produce 20 times as less heat. So what we see then is four curves that result from the applying the equation, which is in the left bottom corner of the slide. So I know all the other parameters, KQ, G, M, and A, I know these parameters. But if I vary the orbital semi-major axis and the value of Q, I obtain four curves that show the time it takes for the various satellites of Saturn to become synchronized. So you see that for, in most cases, for all the inner satellites, Titan and satellites inside Titan's orbit, it's easy to define this object. They could have been synchronous very rapidly, in less than 10 million years, in most cases. But iapetus, it's very different. If we want to be able to define iapetus, the value of its, the dissipation properties of its material have to be less than, the dissipation factor of iapetus has to be less than 50. So that was one of back of the envelope calculation, if you want, that if we want to be able to explain how iapetus became in synchronous rotation, this means that its dissipation factor has to be less than 50. And that was a strong constraint because in order to have such a small value of dissipation factor, we need the body to become warm at some point. And if I go back to the previous two slides earlier, I saw this very dissipated interior to explain iapetus. And it means that you need to have a warm interior in order to explain iapetus. And we need to find the right model that can, at the same time, create warm temperatures in the interior and very cold temperatures in the surface. These were the constraints for the model. So I go to slide number 9, and this is supposed to be a movie, and I hope it's going to work. Can you see the movie? With the X?
On slide 9? I don't think you sent me a movie, but
It's a slide with two pictures of X.
Right.
And when you click on the pictures, nothing is going on.
No.
Oh.
PDFs won't embed movies.
I'm looking at the PowerPoint.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, Julie. If you send it to me, I'll make sure that it gets up on the website for people to use later.
Okay, so that just shows the very simple experiment that can be done with kids, and you take two eggs, one raw egg and one cooked egg, and you make them feed, and you compare how they evolve with time, and it's just a way to illustrate that there is a very strong link between the internal structure of an egg or a satellite and the way it rotates. And so we know that the cooked egg is cold and frozen and is going to spin very fast and for a very long time. And on the other hand, the raw egg has some viscous material going on in the interior and it's going to slow down with time. So it's exactly what we believe it's been going on with iapetus. If iapetus had been very cold and frozen and nothing special happening in its interior, it would have started with a fast spin and it would have kept spinning very fast forever. But what we see is that iapetus slowed down And we believe that at some point its internal structure was similar to what's going on in a raw egg. There was some viscous material that helped Iapetus slow down, and at some point it became in synchronous rotation. So I'm going to then to skip slide number 10, and I go directly to slide number 15. And this is again the same step to illustrate how the rotation period evolves as a function now of temperature. I told you there is an evolution, there is a dependence on the time it takes for an object to spin as a function of the dissipation factor. Here I'm showing the same thing but differently. It shows how it takes for an object to spin, to become in synchronous rotation, as a function of the viscosity in its interior. So the viscosity, we go back to the egg. When you have a frozen egg, it's like the viscosity is very, very large. And if we take the raw egg, the viscosity is relatively small. I'm going to go fast on that slide because I don't think it's very interesting to know exactly the value of viscosity. But just to tell you that we found from the model that at some point in its history, Iapetus internal temperature had to reach the water melting temperature, so about 0 degrees Celsius. So a very important constraint on the evolution of Iapetus is that at some point it had to reach the temperature of liquid water. And again, that was completely unexpected because this object is so small and is so cold. So I go to slide number 12, and now what I'm trying to do now is to understand how it could have been possible that an object like Iapetus had some liquid water in its interior at some point during its history. And so we need to find a lot amount of heat in order to increase the temperature of Iapetus that originally was about -196 degrees, and we want to bring that temperature to 0 degrees Celsius. So it takes a lot of heat to do something like that. And on this slide, I present the temperature in Kelvin. Are you all familiar with the Kelvin scale? Hello?
Well, why don't you go ahead and describe it a little bit so it's in the transcript, Julie.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what this chart shows is as a function of depth in this object, and especially as a function of a depth which is about 20 kilometers, this slide shows the maximum temperature which in this object, and this is just based on some theoretical calculation. I show the various satellites, so by Mastesis and Celadus and Rian, also show Ceres, and I also indicate where the large ice satellites of Jupiter, like Europa and Ganymede, where they fit on that slide. And there are two vertical lines that show some key temperatures we need to, that characterize the satellites. One is the water ice crypt temperature, and so that's the temperature at which the ice tends to deform very easily. And this is important that a satellite can reach that temperature because the satellites of Saturn, they are created very porous. And we need the ice to be able to creep and to flow so that the porosity compacted and at some point this object could become spherical. That's the case of, that's a very important parameter. And I also show the water melting temperature at 270. The ammonia water ice crypt temperature, so because we believe that there is some ammonia that was present in Saturn satellites, so it's important to understand how water and ammonia ice behave as a function of temperature. So same thing, at about 100 Kelvin, a mixture of ammonia and water can flow easily. And at 176 Kelvin, a mixture of ammonia and water can melt, can produce some liquid. And so what we see on this picture is that as a result of accretion, so following formation, there was overall little heat provided to the satellites of Saturn. The amount of heat coming as a result of accretion, that is as a result of many impacts colliding together in order to form a bigger object, is of the order of an increase of temperature, so we have the order of 30 to 40 degrees Celsius. So right after accretion, an object like Iapetus had a temperature which was no larger than 150 Kelvin, which is that we were at about accretion to provide a little bit of heat of Iapetus, but after accretion, we still needed 120 degrees for Iapetus to reach the melting temperature of water. So accretional heat was not enough to expand Iapetus. The reason why I wanted to point this out is that people believed very much that there could be enough heat provided from impacts that could explain Iapetus's state. And this is simply not possible. There is not enough heat resulting from the collision of an impactor with Iapetus. And on top of that, an impactor would have disrupted the surface very much. So if we take a very, very big impactor, yes, maybe it can provide a lot of heat, but the result is that it could also break Iapetus. And we know that Iapetus has not been disrupted. So I put that last slide is a little bit complicated. I'm going to move to the next one.
Which slide are you on?
I'm going to slide 13.
13? Okay, great, thanks.
So that's just a summary of why is it so difficult to find a heat in our satellites. So they are crystalled for us when we make ice in the laboratory. We take just ice from the freezer and we grind it. And the porosity of that ground ice is about 40%. So it's about the same for this object in the outer solar system. The initial porosity is of the order of 40 or 50%. So we need to find a way to decrease the porosity in these objects. The other important aspect of the problem is that water ice at 80 Kelvin is one of the most conductive planetary minerals. It's more conductive than silicate. That is to say, it can conduct heat very fast. And give you an example. I had an example with stainless steel. But stainless steel has a conductivity which is about 20 times the conductivity of ice. But ice, cold ice, has a conductivity, a thermal conductivity, which is about 10 times the conductivity of clay. To give you an example. And we know that, I mean, we use fibers, for example, to insulate a house. We use some fiberglass. So the conductivity of ice at 80 Kelvin is at least one order of magnitude bigger than the conductivity of this fiberglass that we put in a house for insulation. So any heat source that can be in the interior of Iapetus is going to be lost very, very fast, because ice is very conductive. The time scale to warm, as a result, the time scale to warm the interior of an icy satellite as a result of uranium, thorium, and potassium decay is longer than the time it takes for an object like Iapetus to cool. It's going to take several tens of million years for Iapetus to cool, but it's going to take about 1 billion years for Iapetus to reach the water melting temperature, just if the only source of heat is the decay from uranium, potassium, and thorium isotopes. And we don't know whether or not tidal heating was a significant heat source in this object. In the case of Iapetus, it probably was not a heat source. We know that tidal heating was a very significant heat source in Enceladus, and it's probably still a significant heat source in Enceladus. But in Iapetus is very, very far from Saturn, and the dependence of the amount of energy on the distance between Saturn and Iapetus is such that probably the only heat source for Iapetus was the heat from uranium, thorium, and potassium. So it's very difficult to change the model. If you don't mind, I'm going to go directly to slide number 15.
Alrighty.
And it just shows that slide just shows the type of approach we use for the models. Like we want to make sure that in the when we compute the thermal evolution, we also have a good understanding of the dynamical evolution, so the destiny aspect, the evolution of the lithospheric thickness, so the evolution of the thickness of that very cold layer at the surface of Iapetus. We want to make sure that we use right parameter for the properties of ice, so the rheology, and that one is called a constraint, and I will go back to that point later on. And all these models we do are constrained by the spin data and the shape data. So we have to make sure that many parameters are self-consistent. One aspect of this model of Iapetus that we published a couple of years ago is that they included many more parameters than had been done in the... We really tried to do a good job with especially the real parameters, trying to make sure that we had the right value for the ice mechanical properties, also that we use the right values for the ice thermoconductivity properties. We took into account porosity. So that was, I'm going to show you why it's so important to make sure that the input parameters are well constrained for this model. So I go to slide number 16, and it's too much, I go to slide number 17, sorry. So we tried to do something different from what had been done in the past. Most models in the past had been using long-life radioisotopes, so uranium, thorium, and potassium decay heat for modeling the heat production in icy satellites. And I told you earlier that it's not enough. We cannot explain Iapetus just with that. So we tried a lot of several heat sources. We tried impact heating, and I told you earlier the problem with impact heating is that it's just not enough heat. Yeah. We tried to limit heat transfer in some way, like for example by increasing, by playing with the parameters and increase especially the thermoconductivity of the material. So we could make assumptions, for example, that if there are impurities in the ice, clay, for example, if you have a mixture of clay and ice, it's going to decrease the thermal conductivity of the Iapetus at the global scale. But what we found is that in most cases, a low thermal conductivity is also associated with the fact that the material is more compliant, the material is going to deform at low temperature. To give you an example, if we, we considered several materials, a way to insulate and limit the heat transfer, for example, is to have a lot of porosity. The problem of porosity is that porosity can compact very fast. If you have a sponge, for example, you press on the sponge, and the sponge is going to deform very easily. So it's the same thing for Iapetus. If we have a lot of porous material in Iapetus, the problem is that it's not going to be possible for the lithosphere to retain the shape. Because at 33 kilometers difference between the equator and the pole, it's a lot of material that needs to be sustained for a very long period of time, for more than 4.4 billion years. So if we want to decrease the thermal conductivity of the material by adding a lot of porosity, that may be fine for increasing the internal temperature in Iapetus, but the model we get is not going to be able to explain how iapetus could retain a very anomalous. That didn't work. We tried to play with the rheology and by changing parameters, the mechanical properties of ice, and we didn't find anything that was convincing. That could explain both a lot of dissipation and at the same time a shape that was very strong. And these two constraints, two experiments, don't go well together. Having a lot of dissipation in the material, this assumes that the material can deform very easily. But if the material can deform very easily, then it's not possible for that material to be strong enough and retain a very anomalous shape. So we had a hard time trying to find some mechanical properties that could explain the observation. And then we tried to add ammonia. I told you earlier that the presence of ammonia is going to decrease the temperature, or the melting temperature inside Iapetus. So we could reach, we could create some liquid inside Iapetus at very low temperature, at only 176 Kelvin. The problem is ammonia also decreases the creep temperature of ice, which means that at low temperatures, the ice is going to deform very fast, very, much faster than pure water ice. So I'm sure that the last point was clear. When we add ammonia, basically we decrease both the creep temperature of the ice and the water temperature, water melting temperature, the ice melting temperature. We decrease these two parameters by about 100 degrees. So, yes, if we add ammonia to the ice, it's possible to melt Iapetus at low temperature, but the problem, the consequence is that also the ice is going to deform very much at low temperature. So we could be able to explain the despinning, but we will not be able to explain the preservation of the shape if we have ammonia in Iapetus. And then we tried some scenarios of very extreme orbital evolution, like Iapetus may have been very close to Saturn at some point in its history, like it could have been as close as Titan, and in that case, there could have been a lot of tidal dissipation in Iapetus, and then it would have been dragged away to its current position. And we talked a lot with dynamicists and tried to understand if this would be possible. And no, it was not possible, really, it was not. And then we also tried to see if Iapetus could have been a captured object. So basically, whatever happened to Iapetus, we could not explain it inside the Saturnian system. So maybe it had some history in the past that made it the way it is now. And it was captured, and it's the reason why we cannot reconcile its current situation with its shape and the spinning with its current position in the Saturnian system. And it's very difficult to explain how such a huge object could have been captured in the Saturnian system. Phoebe is an example of an object that was captured, and it has very, very peculiar dynamical characteristics. First, its orbit is retrograde, and then it has a very strong eccentricity and inclination. So, it's not the case of Iapetus. Iapetus really looks like an object that was formed in the Saturnian nebula. So, we had the idea of doing something very new, which had not been considered very much in the past. We had the idea of using short-lived radio isotopes, and especially aluminium-26, and see if using these isotopes will make a difference in an object like Iapetus. So, a few words about these isotopes. There are two types of isotopes. Maybe I'll go to slide 19 first. Go to slide 19. This is just a few words about aluminium-26. So meteorists have found in some meteorites, this, like Alien Day, the carbonaceous chondrite at the end there, people have found in this very white globule, I don't know if you can see them in the picture, you have white inclusions in the picture of the Allende meteorite, and these are very rich in calcium and aluminium. And people have found that some anomaly in the content of aluminium and magnesium that made them believe that there was some an isotope of aluminium. There was a lot of aluminium 26, which is an isotope of aluminium, in the parent of the Allende meteorite. And this was detected first in the 1975 or 76, and since then there has been a lot of evidence that there was aluminium 26 accreted in the meteorite parent bodies. And so that's something we know, basically, that there was a lot of aluminium 26 in the inner solar system when the meteorite parent bodies were very young. So the characteristic of aluminium 26.
Possibly, this is Joe Hilby on the CIIs. So there's evidence that Apatis has aluminium 26. Is that correct, or has CIIs?
No, we have no evidence because aluminium 26 is a short-lived radioisotope, so it has
right.
a time of 0.7 million years.
Right, but it just deteriorates, so there's CII, like in meteorites, like the Allende meteorite, you have those inclusions, those CII inclusions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious if there's evidence of that on Iapetus.
We would not be able to see these inclusions on Iapetus, but what's something interesting is that the Stardust mission has been able to sample a comet.
Mm-hmm.
And in the comet Wild 2, in the sample of that comet, so an object which is really typical of the outer solar system, the specialists of the Stardust mission have found something similar to CAIs. So it would not be possible with Cassini remote sensing instruments to detect CAIs on Iapetus, even if they were present, but a direct sampling of a comet has proved the presence of similar type of inclusion in cometary material. So there is another reason that makes us believe that there has been aluminium 26 in the outer solar system objects. It's that there are two ways to explain aluminium 26. One of them is that aluminium 26 would have formed as a result of strong solar winds inside the inner solar system.
Mm.
More recently, it's been suggested that there is more and more evidence that aluminium 26 was providing from another from outside the solar system, from a supernova, and that supernova produced a lot of short-lived radioisotopes, and they were sent to the solar system, and you know all the surroundings of that supernova were flooded by short-lived radioisotopes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. That's why I was kind of interested in the whole idea of a capture. You know, if it had come, you know, conceivably from outside the solar system as we were progressing around the galaxy or something, but. You know, so I think that you've answered that probably would not be the case. I'm just sorry.
Yeah, it's difficult to explain from a dynamical point of view. However, Phoebe is a very interesting object. It's been demonstrated that Phoebe has probably been captured at Saturn. And if you have a chance to look at some press releases of from the Cassini teams that were like mid-2004, after the June 11 flyby of Phoebe by Cassini in 2004, there were some press releases that demonstrated discussed the fact that Phoebe is very anomalous. It has a surface composition which has nothing to do with what we find on the Saturnian satellites, and that object that friend. So, if you're interested in the idea that some of the Saturn satellites have been captured, I recommend you look at this press release about Phoebe. because TB is another very fascinating object for sure.
Yeah, if I can get that maybe later, maybe I can get that through Kay or something, what that information is. And
I can also, I have several of them, I can also...
Right, I understand.
You can send me a, this is Jane Houston Jones, you can send me an email, and I will point you to the press releases. Or you can just go to the Cassini website and go to 2004, but I'll be happy to point you in the direction if you send me an email.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
And if you just send it to Kay, she can get it to me, or you can send it to me directly.
Okay, great. I will do that.
Sure, thanks.
I have a question. How long do I have?
You have until, you don't have to go till 1, but we reserve the telecon for 2 hours.
Okay. So, is the pace okay? Is the information enough or too much?
Oh, it's fascinating. It's wonderful.
Great.
Keep going.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, so you can see on that chart of the slide 19 that I've computed the amount of heat produced as a result of radiogenic decay as a function of time after the formation of CAIs. The reason why we take CAIs as the reference time is that basically this is where we found aluminium 26. So scientists were able to compute what was the initial amount of aluminium 26 in the meteoric iron bodies based on the observations of the CAI. So it's the reason why CAI, the formation of CAI is about the zero for all the results I'm going to show you in the next slide. More recently, people have started thinking a lot about whether or not CAIs were the first solid form in the solar system, and probably they were not, and there was maybe up to 1 million years difference between the beginning of the solar system and the production of CAIs. So, again, the results I'm going to show you, they take the production of CAIs as a zero reference time scale, but maybe any data I'm going to give you, we have to take into account the possibility that the CAIs form 1 million years after the beginning of the solar system. So if you want to have an idea of the timeline on events with respect to the beginning of the solar system, you have to add up to 1 million years to the numbers I'm going to give you. So on that chart slide 19, so the numbers themselves are not very important, but what you see is that the heat from aluminium 26 is so intense that it's almost 3 orders of magnitude larger than the heat provided from long-lived radioisotopes, so uranium, thorium, and potassium isotopes. And on that chart, you see that before 10 million years, there is a lot of heat due to the decay of short-lived radioisotopes. After 10 million years, all the short-lived radioisotopes, and especially aluminium 26, are gone. And suddenly, the only heat source that is available is due to uranium, thorium, and potassium decay, and that's just not enough. So it's a way to explain how IAPC could have become warmer at some point in its history, maybe to assume that it accreted with some aluminium 26 because it formed between 1 and 10 million years after the production of CAI. And that idea was very innovative. Like, there may be a way to provide an absolute date for the formation of the icy satellites and the Saturnian system, because we had to resort to aluminium 26 in order to understand the evolution of Iapetus. So I... Okay, slide number 20. So, such a huge heat source can have a lot of consequences, and we know that from the meteorites. We know that there are categories of meteorites like the carbonaceous chondrite, like for example the Allende meteorites, which show the signs of hydrothermal activity. And it's really the same type of interaction between water and rocks, the same type as has been observed at the bottom of the oceans. And the interaction of water and rock at warm temperature. And that has a lot of consequences, and we know on Earth that in that context there is a lot of interesting chemistry going on, and maybe the possibility for the development of life. So it's the same thing that could have been going on in meteorites and bodies. As a result of aluminium 26, a lot of chemistry going on, and we know that the meteorites are very rich in organics, a very wide variety of hydrocarbon compounds, and these compounds could have formed as a result of hydrothermal alteration. So anything that we know about meteorites and meteorite-bound bodies could apply to the icy satellites if indeed we can prove basically that these satellites are created early enough so that they benefited from the heat from aluminium 26 decay. This aluminium 26, it can result in differentiating very early an icy object because it creates a lot of heat which is going to melt the ice, and in less than 10 million years there can be full differentiation of the interior of the object. It can raise internal temperature high enough for silicate hydration, so that's as a result of hydrothermal circulation. It can raise internal temperature high enough for tidal dissipation to start, and that's not too much applicable to Iapetus, but it could be applicable to Enceladus. If you want to explain how Enceladus became very much dissipative as a result of tidal stress, we may have to give the satellite a little bit of heat initially to offset the dissipation. That's another topic I'm working on. And most important in the case of Enceladus, a heat from aluminium 26 can raise internal temperature high enough for the porosity to decrease, for the ice to flow, and thus for the porosity to compact. And I'm going to show you why it's so important. I mean, I told you earlier the reason why it's so important is that a lot of porosity, it's not going to help much with preserving the very anomalous shape. So something sure is that in the case of Iapetus, we had to decrease the porosity in order to make the lithosphere stronger. I go to slide number 21, and that shows a model of Iapetus without aluminium 26. That is to say, we formed Iapetus later than 6 million years after the production of CEIs. And after 6 million years, the aluminium 26 had decayed a lot. So that plot, that chart, it shows two things. On the left side, it shows the temperature as a function of radius and as a function of time on a logarithmic scale. And the temperature scale is color-coded, so that everything which is in the blue and green is cold. Especially everything, which is in the blue, is so cold that the ice cannot flow. In the green, the ice can flow, and then the porosity can decrease, for example. In the orange color, the ice is at the melting temperature, or pre-melting temperature. And the white color corresponds to a situation when there can be some interaction between the rock and the water. And at darker colors, which are not used for that chart, the darker colors would apply if there was a core in Iapetus. So that's for the left side, sorry. And what you see on the right side is the evolution of the porosity as a function of time. So Iapetus at time zero, 0.1 million years, very early after accretion, Iapetus is cold, very cold, and it's very porous. And at some point, which is about 300 million years after accretion, the temperature starts for the ice to creep. But you can see that on the right side that the porosity is going to remain significant. It's going to be at least 60-70 kilometers of very porous material at the surface. And at some point in that model, the water ice melting temperature is going to be reached. So we reach that orange color. And you see that there is a big radius. And the thin radius is due to the fact that because the spin rate changes very fast as a result of the spinning, the shape is going to change also very fast. The object, Iapetus was spinning fast and the shape was very oblate, and if suddenly the shape changes as a result of, if suddenly the spin rate changes, then the shape is also going to change very rapidly. But what you see in this model is that in the end, it's a very porous model. About 60 to 70 kilometers of the surface is porous, and such a porous layer at the surface is not helping preserve a very oblate shape. The shape is going to relax just because the porous ice is not strong enough to retain a strong shape anomaly. So if I go to the next slide, the same initial conditions, we start with the porous interior, but we also solved the model in such a way that there was a lot of heat coming from aluminium 26, and this is possible if Iapetus was formed between 2.5 and 5 million years after the production of CAIs. So you see that there is a big difference between this result and the result I just showed you. It's at first about 2 million years after formation, 2 or 3 million years after formation, the temperature inside Iapetus reaches the temperature of ice crypt. And as a result, very rapidly, like less than 10 million years, 20 million years after formation, there is almost no porosity in Iapetus. And you can see that on the right chart, that at the end there is maybe 5-10 kilometers of porous ice on Iapetus, but that's very, very small. So it's not going to be a problem for retaining the shape. And as the temperature increases, at some point, yes, there is an increase of temperature until the water ice melting temperature increases and the spinning can occur. And so, but something very interesting is that because there is no porous ice anymore in Iapetus, about 3 billion years after formation, the entire body freezes. In the model, the entire body freezes. So if you go back to the previous slide, you see that in the previous model, we keep relatively warm temperature in this model even today. And this is because porous ice is very insulating. Once again, we can make a comparison between fiberglass used for insulating a house. Fiberglass is very porous. It has a very low thermal conductivity. So same thing for an object like Enceladus. The presence of this very insulating layer is going to prevent significant heat loss over the long term. If we go back to the slide 22, because of that full compaction of Iapetus porosity, there is not this possibility to insulate heat transfer from Iapetus, and about 1 billion years ago with that model, Iapetus would have completely frozen. And the deal here is that it's just great for preserving a shape, a very anomalous shape, to have a non-porous, very cold material that's just optimum for preserving the shape. So the model I'm showing you in slide 22, it's really optimum for despinning at about 200 million years after formation and preserving the very anomalous shape. So I go to slide 23, which is just a zoom of what I'm presenting you. Slide 24. So we've been testing a lot of parameters, and we come to the following conclusion. If we form Iapetus too early and there is too much heat from aluminium 26, what's going to happen is that Iapetus is going to be very hot, It's going to spin very fast. It's going to spin while the lithosphere is thin. And you can go back to slide number 22 that shows the thickness of the cold layer at the surface of Iapetus after formation, at about 2 or 3 million years after formation. You see that the blue layer, the layer at the surface with very cold temperature, is very thin. So if you take that model and you consider that Iapetus could have formed even before 2.5 million years after sea ice, not only there is going to be a rapid convection, but there is going to be a rapid increase to very warm temperature while the object has a very thin lithosphere. And in such conditions, yes, the object can spin, but it's not going to be able to preserve a very anomalous shape. So we came to the conclusion after running a lot of models that Iapetus could not have formed before 2.5 million years after sea ice. And if we form Iapetus too late, after 5 million years, then the body is too cold. And it cannot despin, and it's going to preserve too much porosity. No, especially it cannot preserve, it's going to preserve too much porosity. So that chart shows just the heat provided from Anion 26 as a function of the time of formation. And yeah, and we ran a lot of parameters and situations, and we came to the conclusion that probably Iapetus formed between 2, 3, and 5 million years after the production of sea ice. But obviously, there are a lot of parameters in the model, so we cannot have like a strong and definitive estimate of the absolute time of formation of Iapetus. But we know that Iapetus had to form early enough, so it had aluminium 26. And this has a lot of consequences, because it, basically this means that the Saturnian icy satellites and the meteorites formed at about the same time. The meteorite-bound bodies. Meteorite-bound bodies and icy satellites formed at about the same time. So slide 25, it's something we started thinking after we published that paper in 2007. It so happens that the Spitzer Space Telescope has been gathering for the past 6-7 years, it's been gathering a lot of very nice shots of protoplanetary disks. And the Spitzer observation have demonstrated that a large majority of protoplanetary disks get organized fast, very fast. Sorry, I'm on slide 26. I apologize. I'm on slide 26. So, yeah, we've known from the Spitzer Space Telescope observation that most systems which have a star with the same mass and characteristics as our Sun, most of these systems, they evolve very, very fast. So that's a very interesting comparison we can make between the results obtained with Iapetus and these observations. There is a consistency basically between the two, which is encouraging. And I apologize, I go back to slide 25. Most models that are, of giant planet formation and satellite system formation have a very hard time to form Saturn and the Saturnian satellites in less than 10 million years. We are getting there, because these models are very complicated, so they also rely on having the right computer resources and being able to comprehend some of the many parameters involved in the models. So for a while, it's been very difficult to explain and constrain the time of formation of the Saturnian system. Basically, when we said that maybe Iapetus formed in less than 5 million years, we had a lot of questioning from the community, the astrophysicist community, because they just could not make Saturn that fast. But then Spitzer has been providing all these observations that actually the solar mass systems clear in 3 to 5 million years, and that's very much consistent with our result. So we need to see what's going to unfold in the future, and see if we can have some reconciliation between the theoretical modeling of planetary systems, speed observations, and the model, these models of Iapetus. So just an illustration on slide 27. It's just artist paint of a system that even cleared in about 1 million years. So that means that the system first was a mass of gas and dust, and suddenly it could become organized with very well identified planets with their own systems, and all this dust and gas was cleared away, and in that case it's just 1 million years. So again, it's not crazy to believe that probably the Saturnian system formed between 1 and 5 million years after the beginning of the solar system. So a few words about something I approached very rapidly earlier, which is using constraints from the laboratory in order to develop better models, because these models, they rely very much on understanding the mechanical properties of ice, whether it's porous ice with impurities, ice with clays, and we just don't have the right data obtained at the right temperature. So 2 years ago, because we had so much interest and also a lot of debate with that Iapetus model, I started a laboratory to measure the data I needed for the model. And something especially we don't know very well is how ice produces heat as a result of cyclic stressing. So that friction I referred to earlier, how ice is going to produce heat when it's subject to some cyclic friction. So all the models we've been using, they rely on a model that is called the Maxwell model. Everyone is using that model. So we started to do something that was very new. I go to slide number 29. Maxwell model, it assumes that basically you can describe any material or any object as the association of a dashpot and a spring. And depending on the speed at which the object is deformed, then one component, the elastic component or the viscous component, is going to be predominant. So sorry, the viscous component corresponds to the dashpot and the elastic component corresponds to the spring. So imagine that you deform that spring more plus dashpot very fast, then it's the spring which is going to react first. So for example, you pull the ball at the end of spring very fast, so spring is going to deform first. And if you keep pulling that ball at the end of the spring, then the dashpot is also going to move, but with some delay. So when an object is subject to cyclic stress, we don't pull on that object for a very long time. We pull a little bit, and then we release the stress, and then we pull again, and we release the stress again. So there is never enough time for the object to deform viscously if it deforms very fast. The elastic behavior is going to be the predominant behavior. On the other hand, if the object is subject to deformation, cyclic deformation, but on a very long time scale, very long period, then we pull on that object. So yes, first the elastic behavior is going to dominate the response of the satellite, of the icy object, and then the dashpot is going to be able to move. And if the period during which we do that is long enough, then the dashpot is going to be the predominant behavior, predominant behavior of characterizing the satellite on a very long time scale. And then if we release the stress, then the spring is going to react first, and then the dashpot has also enough time to relax as well. But this is very simplistic, because basically it works either if we have very rapid deformation or very long deformation on a very long period. And then it's possible for each element of that string plus that spot to be expressed and dominate the deformation. But in real life, it's not what's going on. So just give one more example on that slide. I'm not going to talk about the chart. I'm just going, one example is the case of glaciers. Glaciers can flow, and so basically they are subject to some deformation, which is the same, applying the same way for very long time scale. So in the case of glaciers, the viscous deformation is dominating the way the glaciers behave. The reason why people use the Maxwell model very much is that it's very simple. It just depends on the elasticity and the viscous properties of the material, which can be determined quite well. But what we want to do is to make more detailed measurements. So I go to slide number 30, and that shows the facility that we have implemented in my lab about 18 months ago. And that shows a compression system. So that's very simple. You can see on the right a detail of what's going on in the blue box. We have an icy sample, a cylinder, which is about 1 inch in diameter and 3 inches tall, and it's stuck between two platens, and these platens, the upper platen can go up and down, so it can press on the sample and then release that pressure, and we can make this happen on a regular basis, like a sinusoidal deformation. The whole sample and platens are enclosed into a shield of copper and that just for thermal stability. And then all this is inside the blue box pictured on the left. And that blue box, it has the capability to reach temperatures as low as 77 Kelvin. So that's the liquid nitrogen temperature. So we can create conditions which are similar to what is found on icy satellites. And the rest of the picture, it just shows that the black box at the top is just the motor, the hydraulic motor that controls the motion of the platen. And all the rest are buttons and commands, and I'm not going into too much detail. So I go to slide number 31st. And it just shows the capability of that system. It shows, the chart shows the tidal stress achieved in this object, and that's just the detail. You don't care about the exact number, as a function of the tidal forcing frequency. And that one is an interesting parameter, because that chart shows that the Saturnian satellites, are subject to cyclic tidal stress with frequency between 10 to minus 7 and 10 to minus 5 hertz. So this means that for my mass it's about 19 hours, and in the case of Iapetus it's about 80 days. And you can see once again that Iapetus is very outside, it's an outsider with respect to the other satellites. It's subject to a very, very low very small tidal stress and frequency. So our system has the capability to simulate the tidal stress in Maimas and Celadus, Tethys, and more recently, I need to update that slide, more recently we've been able to achieve conditions similar to what's going on in Europa. So that was unique, because other teams have tried to do that some type of measurements, and they've just been able to achieve frequencies of the order of 10 to minus 2 hertz. So when an object is subject to stress at 10 to minus 2 hertz, it's very fast, it's a period of 100 seconds, and then the response of the material is going to be dominated by its elastic behavior. But what we want to see is what's going on when we go to very low periods, which are really relevant to satellites. In order to better, to very well constrain what we do, we've been working with monocrystalline ice to start, just as a start, because monocrystalline ice has its own way of deformation, which is a function of default dislocations inside its structure. So first we started with monocrystalline ice, and more recently we've been working with a polycrystalline ice. And we work with a glaciologist at Caltech who makes a very pure and ice-free sample, a bubble-free sample for us. So I'll go to slide number 33. So what this shows is an example of test. So we apply a cyclic pressure, a cyclic load on the sample, or cyclic stress, and we make a very long experiment because we want to get a lot of cycles in order to make sure that we understand very well what's going on with our material. And you can see on that chart that we, for that test, we perform about two series of cycles at with a period of about 3 hours, and then we try to simulate Enceladus, and then we try to simulate Europa, so with a cycle which is about 92 hours long. And so if you click, you could see there is an animation. So first we see the test, the blue curve, just the stress, and then we see the strain, the response of the sample which appears. And so you can see that the red curve now is the measurement of the deformation of the sample as a function of the stress, in response to the cyclic stress. So in response to a sinusoidal cyclic loading, there is a sinusoidal response. But on top of that, there is a creep of the material, which explains that there is a very strong slope of the material, because on top of the deformation that occurs cyclically at short periods, there is a very long period trend, and this is just ice flowing, like the icy sample in the compression system is flowing in the same way that a glacier is flowing. And it's because under a constant stress, a constant mean stress, and over a very long period, the viscous behavior dominates the response of the sample. So it's the reason why you see that there are basically two deformations superimposed, one on each other, the short, the sinusoidal deformation at short period, and then this trend of flow on a very longer time scale. And what we are looking for is a phase, a time difference between the maximum of compression and the response of the sample, the maximum deformation of the sample. And that is a parameter that we call data, and which is a phase lag. And the phase between stress and deformation is direct information about the dissipation of the material. And what we found so far is that anything that had been done in the past which was not constrained by laboratory data is just not applicable, and we need to revise everything. So I go to the next slide, slide 34, and we are close to the end, and that just shows an example of results we've obtained. This chart shows the phase lag, the sinus of the delta parameter, as a function of frequency, the period, the cyclic frequency, that's equivalent to the tidal frequency. And that's for a test that was performed at minus 30 degrees C. And there are many things on that chart, but I would like you to focus on the green circles and the green line. And the green line is a fit of the green circles. And what you see is that the green light is The green line has is very different from the Maxwell model, the black line. And there is a strong difference, not so much at low frequencies lower than 10 to minus 4 hertz, but very obvious at higher frequencies. So what we demonstrated is that the Maxwell model is not applicable, and we've been able to demonstrate this problem at all temperatures between 0 and minus 50 degrees so far. So that's going to be a problem for the models. So just to some conclusions, slide 35. So we hope that future Cassini observation will help constrain the formation time scales for the Saturn system, and especially on slide 36, I have provided a few examples of what is the consequences of forming the Saturn satellites at the same time as Iapetus, a few million years after the beginning of the solar system or the production of CAI. And so we know that because of that intense amount of heat provided on a very short time scale, some objects could differentiate somewhat, and that's possibly the case of Rhea, the case of Dione, and we know that Dione has signs of geological activity that could be related to internal geological activity, internal activity, and as a result of differentiation. And Enceladus is probably the most interesting case because we know with our model that we can explain how Enceladus differentiated. And it's the only model so far that can explain how Enceladus could differentiate. Enceladus is a very small object, and we know that the heat from long-life radioisotopes only cannot bring Enceladus internal temperature to the point that it could differentiate and become a source of heat. There could be a heat source as a result of tidal heating. So for Enceladus, using Orion 26, it's very convenient because it results in rapid differentiation, and so maybe the key to confirming basically that the Saturn system formed very fast after the beginning of the solar system is maybe by better understanding Enceladus. And then slide 37, so just to summarize, more observation will help better understand the early history and the evolution of the Saturn satellites. So by looking at the ongoing and past geological activity, how the craters evolved and relaxed, how the shape relaxed, constraints on the internal structure, for example for Dione and Rhea, and also the surface composition. So I'm done. I'm sorry it was a bit long.
Oh, thank you so much, Julie. That was a fascinating, fascinating talk. Before I announce the what we're going to be hearing about next month, does anybody have any final questions for Julie?
I have one. Julie.
Yes. Go ahead.
Kibi Marin. Do you think that the orbital change in orbit could have caused one of the Saturn rings to collapse in the surface of Iapetus? Kind of similar if you're walking in mud and then you get a string and you put it on the mud and then you make your mark, and as the mud dries, it gives you a little ridge. Do you think that one of the theories is up there?
It would require that first the surface becomes warm enough. And the idea is that the ridge could have formed as a result of cooling, basically. Like you have a surface which is warm and mushy, and it dries and cools. There can be a lot of thermal stress associated with that that could create a ridge, and we know that it's been happening on some objects, for example, Rhea. But it's difficult to understand how the ridge could be exactly at the equator. I don't know. And then, if there is a coincidence, if the surface was warm and at the same time there was a ring of material that collapsed on the warm material, yes, maybe. I don't know. It's difficult in the first place to understand how the ridge could have been. How the surface could have been warm. So, I don't know, it's work in progress. We have found, I mean, we have found, it's not me, but I mean, Gassini, scientists have found ridge around Rhea. That was found relatively recently, much after the studies of Iapetus. So maybe, yeah, maybe there was a ring of material around Iapetus. It's very hard to tell, really.
Does anybody else have any questions before I tell you about next month's talk? Well, first of all, I'd really like to thank Julie for taking the time to bring this talk to us. It was really interesting to see the work in the laboratory as opposed to some of the other talks we've had. So this was new and exciting. Next month, we're going to have a talk about Rhea, so very much tying right into what Julie's been talking about, and Dr. Geraint Jones is going to be talking about Rhea, and probably he'll be talking about things like the rings around Rhea that have been discovered using the MIMI instrument. The MIMI is the magnetospheric imaging instrument, and that measures the flow of electrons through Saturn's magnetosphere. So that's coming up the last weekend in February, and then in March our talk will be Ralph Lorenz talking about Titan. So some great talks to follow up this wonderful talk. And unless anybody has any final thing to say, Julie will let you get some lunch.
Thank you so much. I was really glad to.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks everybody. We'll talk to you all next month. And whoever was asking the question about the press releases about Iapetus. If you send me an email to jane.h.jones@jpl.nasa.gov, I'll be happy to point you to those, or you can just send your question to Kay Ferrari, since you're a solar system ambassador. And
yeah, I can send it to you.
Okay, super. And I'll be happy to point those, and then they'll also end up, maybe we'll even put the link to that on the charm page. So, thanks a lot for some great questions and a wonderful presentation. And goodbye, everyone.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Thank you.